They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, joining us today is an old friend, someone who hasn't been on for a long, long time, and I'm thrilled and delighted to have Professor Evan McKenzie on with us today. Evan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Shu. Good to be talking to you again.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I hope we don't wait this long again in the future. But you've been you just got back from Israel.
Yes.
And I guess there's a lot of people from around the world talking about homeowner associations there, right?
That is correct, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure.
What happened?
This conference was in Herzliya, which is just north of Tel Aviv in Israel. And it's an international conference called Private Communities and Urban Governance, Theoretical and Comparative Perspectives. And it was organized by what's called the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya. They have a real estate institute there. It's basically a university. They have a law school and everything else. And we had a number of us it's another one of these networks. I've been part of a network of European and other scholars, mostly urban planners and geographers, and we produced books and had conferences and so forth. And this is a different network. This is mostly lawyers, attorneys, law professors, and so forth, mostly. And we were organized by Professor Amnon Lahavi, who was at IDC Herzliya. And so we had people from China, Russia, Germany, Spain, U.S., several Israeli representatives talking about this. And the conference really was a very fascinating, kind of eye-opening view into what's going on around the world. I mean, I've known this for a long time, but it's just see that how universal the phenomenon of condominium housing is, and also HOAs, but in a lot of countries around the world, it's condominiums because of the need to build at high density. They tend to go with the condominium form. But it's going on all over Europe, all over Asia, all over South Africa. We had someone from South Africa at the conference as well. There's a new book out on condominium law in Europe. It's a study of all the condominium laws of Europe by Professor Cornelius van der Merwe, who is at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. He's a law professor. And so, this is a very well-developed body of law. And also, it has become the default type of housing in a lot of places around the world. Places you wouldn't think of, like Spain and Russia and so forth. This is what they're building. And common interest housing is the way people are building in China, in Israel, and elsewhere. I saw condominium buildings in Tel Aviv that are just absolutely enormous. I mean, I'm talking like 50-story condominium buildings that are going up around Tel Aviv. That's the only way they can build. I mean, condominium housing is not only and other forms of common interest housing are not only the default in this country, they are the default around the world as well. So it's quite remarkable. And some of the same issues come up in other countries as the issues that we deal with here. We talked about them at the conference. One major issue, and this is what my paper was mainly about, is the financial challenges facing associations since 2008. And as I've been arguing for many years, I mean going way, way back, that this type of housing places too much reliance on the resources of individual owners and that it's really not sustainable in its current form unless there's some institutional support. A lot of associations, I said this many years ago, were going to fail, and a lot of them have failed. A lot of, we don't know how many, I'm trying to get data on this to try to quantify this, but we know that particularly in Florida, Nevada, and a number of other places where there was a lot of overbuilding during the housing boom, that hundreds and hundreds of associations have failed. There have been many associations, condo buildings, that have simply been turned into apartment buildings. They've just given up. The condominium form is gone. At least 200 of them here in Chicago alone. And for many, many more, I think, in Florida and Nevada and some of the real boom towns. So you know, they just can't. And this is going on all over the world. That is, there are ghost town subdivisions and defunct condo associations in countries all over the world.
So why are they failing, Evan? What's driving them to fail?
Well, with several things. I think part at the root of it, really, more than anything else, if you look at one particular aspect of it, and you isolate this as the most common cause, it is converting old apartment buildings into condominiums and selling them to people of moderate income. That is the single biggest problem, because these condo conversion buildings are often, they look okay because they dress them all up on the outside, but the internal building systems often are falling apart at the time they're sold as new housing, because it's an old apartment building. And they typically sell these things to people of moderate incomes, and it's this effort to make home ownership affordable. That's what we did here in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, from '95 till the crash of the market in 2007, the whole idea was to try to find all these ways to get people to buy houses who otherwise wouldn't have been able to, and a ton of that was common interest housing, and a lot of it was apartments that were converted to condos. And they're sold to people, you know, cocktail waitresses, you know, people who work in convenience stores and whatnot. We're buying $300,000-$400,000 condos on all these weird speculative mortgages. Now, it wasn't quite as bad all around the world, but the same principle was at work. Build a lot of housing and turn it and make it housing, not public housing, not rental housing, but sell it to people and get them to buy into this and create this real estate market. And it's been causing a lot of problems because people don't have the capital to repair the buildings when they go bad. And often they can't even afford the operating expenses. And then when property values went down, it hit everybody around the world. And a lot of people ended up holding the bag, you know, with long-term loans to pay off mortgages on property that wasn't worth what they paid for it.
We've seen that twice, back in the, late 80s, early 90s, when housing was worth a lot less than people owed mortgages on. I mean, they were having to come to the table with hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get rid of the property. And then didn't learn anything, did we? We just went ahead and it was back to business as usual.
Yeah, well, the 80s, you know, one of the phenomena of the 80s that we paid no attention to and didn't learn from was deregulating the savings and loan industry, which Reagan did. And Carter signed one bill, but Reagan signed the big one, the Garn-St. Germain Depository Institutions Act. And they deregulated savings and loans, which had always been a tightly regulated industry that did nothing but almost nothing but make home loans. That's what they did. It was a very conservative institution. And they wanted to start competing with the banks because of interest rates were going up, and people were taking their money out of S&Ls and putting them in banks where they could get higher interest rates. So the solution was deregulate the savings and loan industry. And what happened was real estate developers started buying savings and loans and lending money to people to buy houses from them. I mean, if you own, it's like owning your own ATM, you know. They would use these federally insured S&Ls as an ATM, essentially, to lend money to people to buy houses from them. And a lot of that was common interest housing, and it contributed to this overbuilding. We've had this pattern just overbuilding housing and overbuying and trying to, you know, increase the home ownership rate. And at some point, you know, I mean, it's dropping in this country now because it just went so high that people were buying houses who absolutely could not afford to do anything to them. And a lot of this was common interest housing. Now, if you have a single-family home and you can't afford to fix it properly, you know, there are things you can do. There's sweat equity. And it only hits one person. But when you're in a condo building, your fortunes are linked to maybe 29 other homeowning families and individuals. And you have to make collective decisions about the building. And the buildings are way, way more complex than a single-family home. And the decision-making process is way more complex than me deciding whether I want to, you know, cut down a tree in my backyard or not. I can just make up my mind and take, get estimates and do it. But if you're in a condo building, this gets much more complicated. The whole decision-making process is much more complicated because it's a collective decision. And you know, these collective financial decisions are especially problematic when you have to decide how much money do we set aside in reserves for future repairs and what kind of information do we need in order to make that decision. And a lot of people in associations, especially people of moderate means, have really made bad decisions. So a large part of my paper was about a lot of these bad decisions. You know, I talked about a whole series of terrible decisions that people made after the Northridge earthquake. The people, these associations like the LaPar case, Oak Park Calabasas, Kingsbury Court, all these cases where association directors made horrendous mistakes, costing their residents millions of dollars, where they ended up with judgments against their associations in the millions of dollars, $4 million, $5 million, $6 million judgments against their association. And then the owners are astonished when they discover that this is their debt, ultimately, not directly, but it's indirectly their debt, because you can't just bankrupt the association of the corporation. You can't. It doesn't work. The debt is the debt, ultimately, of the owners. They have to pay the debts of the corporation. And that's what came out of those rulings. I'm sure very few people living in condos today or HOAs today understand that they will be financially responsible for the bad decisions, if any happen, of their board of directors.
Well, you made that. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You made that point on your blog, Privatopia. Blogspot.com, and you said most U.S. condo and HOA owners do not know that they are liable for for the debts of the association.
Right.
That's a problem, because we're not doing a good enough job of disclosing all the information, are we?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, the kind of, I think this is really a terrible thing. It's one of my proposed solutions. It's in this paper that I just did, but we have to find some way of, I mean, this is what policymakers ought to be concerned about. They're always talking about how great markets are. Let's find a way to disclose a lot more information publicly about association finances and their state of affairs, their financial and legal state of affairs. Let's get a lot more information out in public, on the internet, so that people can access it. It should be in Secretary of State website or condominium ombudsman website. It should be somewhere where anyone can access it, instead of this nonsense about where you have to actually make a contract to buy a particular condo unit before your attorney can make a specific request of the association and the owner to tell you certain specified things about the association's finance. I mean, it's only after you're already committed that you can find out what shape a condo association is in. I think that's crazy. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. And it kind of encourages associations, really, I think, to take financial risks they shouldn't take. And, you know, I'd rather get the information out, and then everyone would be able to, before they went to look at a unit in the condo, they could find out whether they really want to take that step or not. You know, is it an association I even want to know about? You know?
Well, the thing is that, I mean, I had someone in here from CAIO at the beginning of this show, 15 years ago when I first started doing this, and he said, well, you guys agreed to it, you knew about it, we disclose all this information. I said, let's disclose everything. And he looked at me, and I don't remember exactly who it was, he looked at me and he said, are you crazy? If people knew what they were getting into, they wouldn't buy into an HOA.
Well, that's exactly the point.
Yes.
That's exactly the point. I mean, the people who, the lawyers and the judges and everybody, wants to hold everybody to this myth that they were fully informed consumers, they knew exactly what was going on, they made a knowing, informed decision to buy the unit, and therefore they should be stuck with all the consequences. Okay, that is a long-standing position in American law, that if you sign a contract, you are conclusively presumed to have done all that. But it's not the problem with condos and HOAs is that, first of all, the documents are so complex and so hard to understand that it's very unrealistic to assume that people read and understood them. Even often lawyers don't understand them. But going beyond that, you can't even get at some of the most basic information until after you've already entered into the contract.
Yeah, yeah.
And that completely blows a hole in this whole informed consent argument. You are bound by the contract. Your down payment is there. Your earnest money is on the line. And if you pull out of the thing, you might get sued just because you don't like the looks of their finances. You have to be very careful about this. And it shouldn't be that way. It should be public. It should be people should know the finances of these associations. And then that caveat emptor, buyer beware argument would make a lot more sense. But you can't, in my opinion, the industry people can't have it both ways. I mean, they shouldn't be allowed to have it both ways.
I think
say on the one hand, well, you know everything, and then on the other hand, to make sure we don't know everything.
Yeah, I think I want to take it a step beyond where you've taken it, and that is before you even go and look, because buying a house is an emotional purchase. You buy a house based on some of the most insane and ridiculous reasons. It smells like grandma's brownies in the oven, or I like the couch and it's not going to stay, or, you know, the sun coming in through that window is wonderful, or wouldn't it be nice if we could have a glass of wine on the patio right here, sitting, I'll put a table here. So it's an emotional purchase. But I think that the agents need to let you know ahead of, here's the financial information about this association. There are 3 units in this association. I will only show them to you if you understand what you're getting into.
Yeah, well, that might work. I don't know. I just feel that right now the current state of affairs is that as with many things involving common interest housing, there's the theory and then there's the reality.
The practice, right.
Yes, and the reality of the practical aspects of how people get into this housing and how they run them and everything else is not consistent with with this idealized model that people in the industry talk about and sell to policymakers. It isn't working the way they say it's working. The most basic disparity, I think, is between what they assume owners will do and how much money they assume owners will have and the reality of owners' actual resources. I mean, this whole model assumes all kinds of resources, such as knowledge, how to run a meeting and how to run a corporation, the willingness to inform yourself about the laws and the governing documents and the changes in the laws that happen every year, the money you have to spend on this, the time you're willing to spend and devote to it, and for a position on these boards that doesn't even pay anything. And the reality is very different than that. And the whole model rests on what I think is a flawed assumption, which is that the owners have enough resources to keep these associations going. Maybe, you know, for wealthy people, but what do? They hire professional managers. And here's this incredible irony. The more affluent the project, the bigger the project, and the more affluent the people, the more likely they are to hire professional help. Even though they have the money and the resources and presumably the people to potentially self-manage, the bigger the association, the wealthier it is, the more likely they are to hire a manager. But the smaller associations with fewer people to choose from, a smaller expertise pool, a smaller human capital pool, and the less money they have, the more likely they are to have to do it themselves because they can't afford all these helpers.
Well, not
so you have all these small associations that are self-managed by people who don't even know what they're doing and don't have any money, running on a shoestring or less.
Well, not all managers are really that knowledgeable. I mean, I've run into some real doozies out there. So I think there's a problem with educating them, with having real professionals and people who know what they're doing.
Well, that's the other issue. Another issue I tried to talk about in this paper, which is that the advocates for this type of housing have always said that this is, and I've said the same thing too, it's true, that this is a privatization of local government functions. That's absolutely true. But when these functions, you know, trash collection or whatever it might be, when they are performed by local government, you have to think about the institutional support that local governments have in our system. And compare that with the institutional support that these privatized local governments have. And the answer is, for residential community associations around the country, they have virtually no institutional support at all. No level of government will take responsibility for backing them up financially, for resolving their conflicts at low cost, for training the directors, for anything. Government has washed their hands and said, okay, you folks, you know, you run your own community, and we're not taking any responsibility for your problems. But now look at when the municipalities are doing these functions. There is an entire profession called public administration that has been around for 125 years or more, that is well organized, that we have public administration departments in major universities all over the world, certainly all over the United States, where people are trained to help run cities as city managers, and we have the urban planning profession. All these people work for cities. They help cities make intelligent decisions. They have entire organizations like the National League of Cities and a similar organization for counties and other organizations for state governments. And municipalities, if necessary, if it's really bad, can go bankrupt under Chapter 9 of the bankruptcy code if their state allows it, and can actually reorganize their finances. They don't do a liquidation, of course, but they reorganize their finances and can get out of a lot of their contracts. It's complicated to explain, but HOAs and condo associations, for them, going bankrupt is extremely risky. You're just passing along the debts of the association to the owners. Well, it's a catastrophe. And the other thing is, cities can issue bonds. You know, local governments, including special districts, can issue bonds. They can borrow money, essentially, at very low rates, is essentially what they're doing with these bonds. Well, look at the borrowing capabilities of associations. They go begging to some bank when they need a loan, and they end up with some really onerous terms. I mean, banks really make it, they're worried about associations going under, and they have jacked up their loan requirements and made it very hard for associations to borrow. So, I mean, there's no institutional support, but there's nobody backing them up. There's nobody who's going to bail them out.
There's one HOA that I know of. Actually, I know of two HOAs that have dismantled the HOA. One of them flat out dissolved the HOA because they could, and everybody got together. I think there was one person who abstained from voting, but virtually everyone else in that section of the HOA voted in favor of dissolving the association. The other one is one that we've covered on this show and I've talked about a number of times, and that's in Virginia, Old Belhaven. They did go bankrupt. The board members responsible for the big issues actually had to come up with the money. The homeowners got together, and although dissolving the HOA was not easy, they chose not to do that. What they did was they gutted the HOA. So the HOA essentially had no power. There were no covenants left. There was nothing left there. No architectural control committee, no nothing. The result is people got together, they worked together. When it snowed, they went around and they collected money to hire someone to come in and plow the streets. They had parties. It became more of a community as opposed to a war zone. And people actually were able to make changes, repairs to their homes that they hadn't been allowed to make. And the result is that property values actually went up, that the HOA was repressing property values. So that's a great model. I love to talk about that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad it worked out that way for them. You know, we've got over 300,000 associations in the country.
Right.
And the only outfits, the only associations that can do what you're describing probably are the HOAs.
Yes.
Because they can dispose of the common areas and people actually own their units. That's, you know, a little more than half of the common interest developments. 45% are condo associations. And doing away with a condo association, the only way you can do that, if it's attached housing, which almost all of them are, is to turn it into an apartment building or a housing cooperative. And, you know, the problem is you need, in most cases, unanimous consent to do this. And it's a real problem. I mean, in Florida, I know they've lowered the threshold for these vulture capitalists to come in and dissolve the associations. And here in Illinois, we have the Distressed Condominium Property Act, which allows the municipality, and usually it's almost in all cases the city of Chicago, to go in and dissolve have a receiver appointed and dissolve a condominium project. But this is Chicago's unique. We have certain institutions here that work very, very well in housing policy, and Community Investment Corporation and the City Attorney's Office and the Housing Court, they all got together on this. And so they've got a well-oiled machinery for this. Most places they don't. And most places the condos are just, some of them are just, as they say, busted projects. and you have squatters living in them. And this is, by the way, this is not just in the U.S. I mean, this is, I was talking with one of my colleagues who has been studying Brazil. This is going on in Brazil. And she's also studied China. It's happening in China. I mean, you get, you know, projects that just stop functioning, and they just become a real problem. And then they somehow, government has to get involved. And in the U.S., it's usually the legal system that does it. You know, it ends up in court somehow.
And it costs more money.
Well, yes. But, I mean, what happens is that the idea here in our system usually is that some kind of an investor gets involved and tries to buy all the units at very low cost because they aren't worth much since the association has collapsed. And maybe the utilities have been shut off, the property taxes haven't been paid, you know, people are in foreclosure, whatever it is. Somebody has to create unity of ownership. And that's what Community Investment Corporation does here in Chicago when they're appointed as receiver for a defunct condo building. They unify the title. This is, they know what they're doing. They're very good at this. In most cases, though, around the country, it would simply be some real estate investment combine of some sort. And they would try to buy all the, unify all the interests so they can do whatever they want with the building. And that can be a brutal process.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't, the owners can lose a tremendous amount of money. And I know of situations like this, and I know you know of situations like this as well, where owners are simply told, listen, you know, we'll give you, okay, you bought your unit for $200,000. We'll give you $35,000 for it, and that's that.
Yeah. Condo terminations, yeah.
Yeah, you'll just, you know, it's going to be the end of you. We'll just get rid of you. So you're going to lose your shirt. So it's, so, these are difficult situations, and that's because there's no institutional support for these associations. And when things go bad, you know, condos get hit first, and affordable condos get hit first of the first.
They're the ones that seem to have the biggest set of problems. I mean,
they do.
They're poorly constructed. They're poorly managed. They're just, it's just a mess. And the other, I mean, I'm getting off a little bit, but the other thing that concerns me, and I have a feeling that down the road we're going to be seeing some real problems, is Housing for Humanity. Although I think they're an absolutely incredible organization, I think they've done some wonderful stuff. But they're taking people and they're building them HOAs. They're taking people who have not been able to save up enough for a down payment to buy into a house, and then making them responsible for repairing and maintaining expensive infrastructure.
Yeah.
And down the road, I mean, that's great. We've made them homeowners and wonderful. But down the road, we've set them up for failure, which I think is cruel.
Yeah, this is exactly the failed model that we've been talking about. This is what everyone was trying to do between 1996 and 2006 or 7, that whole 10-year period when the housing market went completely blue. This is what was going on. Oh, gee, let's make everybody a homeowner.
Yeah.
And the Hope 6 program, they were trying to take former public housing tenants and get them somehow in these buildings, and affordable condos everywhere, mainly by converting old dilapidated apartment buildings into condos. The building owners made a fortune, and a lot of people got stuck with buildings that where the elevator stopped functioning within 6 months, and then it turned out that they have mold in the building, and then, wait a minute, the roof leaks, and the underground parking garage is admitting water, et cetera, et cetera. And guess what? Those 30 owners, whatever it is, have to pay for all of it.
And they can't do it.
And for some reason, you know, I mean, our policymakers seem to be so enthralled with the idea of everyone being a homeowner, you know, that they fall for these proposals to put people in old condo buildings that they can't maintain. It's just really we just do it over and over, and I just think that, you know, there are many better ways to do this. One way that I think should be considered is housing cooperatives, which, you know, sure, you still have responsibilities for buildings, but, you know, housing cooperatives have a lot of advantages, and for people of moderate income and means. You can have limited equity housing cooperatives, and you don't have this problem with this speculation, the driving up of the values, and people buying and selling and coming in and out, all these absentee owners. and rented out units and all this stuff. The idea with a co-op is the people have an investment in the building and they live there, and they accept that they're sharing space with people, and they accept the rules and they accept the financial obligations, which are hopefully, you know, manageable for them. And, you know, here in Chicago, I believe, I think I'm correct in saying this because my friend Herb Fisher, who's the maybe the best co-op lawyer in the country, or one of them, has said this to my classes, that there really weren't any failures of co-op buildings in the housing crash, because they didn't have the spectacular rise in property values followed by the crash and everybody trying to sell and being underwater in individual mortgages. They have blanket mortgages on these buildings. And, you know, it was just, it's a different financial structure, and it's more resilient for people of moderate means. But, you know, American real estate development industry has no interest in co-ops at all. Neither does the banking industry. Neither does the title insurance industry. They want multiple sales, multiple fees, you know, free alienability of interest. They want, you know, it's all about making as many sales as possible.
You know, we had co-ops here in Virginia, and they did not survive. They all, I'm not going to say they failed, but they did not do well. And in fact, a lot of them, as soon as they could, converted to condos.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think we have one or two left, but there were a number of them. In fact, in my real estate selling days, I became known as the co-op queen because nobody knew how to sell them, nobody knew how to market them, and nobody knew how to close them. So finding an attorney who knew how to close it, I mean, I was educating the settlement attorneys that this is what you need, and you've got a proprietary lease involved in this. But then finding a bank.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
They, you know, there were one or two banks, and they owned all the mortgages in there.
Yeah. Well, all I can tell you is here, there are a lot of condos. A lot of co-ops in Chicago, and obviously a lot in New York City.
And in Washington, yes.
Yeah, and they've been here in Chicago. They've been very successful, and they've been around since, the 1920s. Some of them are, you know, they range from places where each unit costs $6 million, and they're on the lakefront, to places that, you know, you can buy in for, you know, $10,000. So there's a huge range, and they've done quite well.
They're, location, 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 right, on the lake?
Well, yeah, and also, yeah, absolutely. And also, yeah. It's just that I think there's a critical mass. I mean, there are enough of them here in Chicago that people do know what they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We didn't have that many of them, and they did not survive. So I don't know. They started building them, and people didn't like them, so selling them was not easy. But anyway, so we're talking to Professor Evan McKenzie, and he's always got some amazing ideas and insights into what's going on in American housing, controlled housing, whether they're co-ops or condos or homeowner associations. Evan, what's the solution? What's the idea? I mean, where do we go from here? We've obviously seen that everything we've tried has not worked out the way we thought they would.
Well, the way I would approach it is I don't want to get into too far into making all sorts of specific proposals. When I do that, I just write them down. But the big picture has been that, you know, for a long time, this type of housing was entirely unregulated. I mean, there was almost no oversight or regulation or anything. And then starting in the mid-1990s, approximately, we started to see the emergence of kind of a regulatory scheme in a number of states. You know, more detailed laws about how to run the internal processes of associations, the emergence of these ombudsman offices, some attempt to keep some records. I make some information available that you find in a number of states now. You can at least get some information in five or six states. And that was moving along. You know, I think things were going in that direction from the mid-90s until the housing market crashed. And when the housing market crashed, it affected local government finances, including state government finances in a lot of states. And people have been busy picking up the pieces in a lot of these states, like Florida, you know, the places where there was the most common interest housing, Florida, California, Arizona, Texas, these places, you know, they've been picking up the pieces, with the, as we've been discussing, for a lot of associations that were really struggling, and underwater owners and banks owning huge numbers of units and all this type of stuff. And I think that really slowed down the legislative reform efforts. The legislatures, state legislatures, have been a lot more concerned with other matters. I mean, way more concerned with other matters. And so now the market, the real estate market, is a little stronger, and I'm sure things are looking up in a number of states. But what I see happening, this is kind of what I was talking about in my paper, what I see happening now is that institutions like banks, the GSEs like Fannie Mae and everything, the FHA, and state and local governments, I think they've backed off substantially. I mean, this is a generalization, and I understand that. It's not always true. But they have tended to back off the movement for reforming the association's functions. And instead, it seems like they're trying to insulate themselves. The big institutions, private and public, are trying to insulate themselves from financial loss and the problems, the externalities that go along with associations not functioning properly. And so, like you see, the banks are really fighting over these super priority liens. They're going to court over this. Fannie Mae is in court over it. A number of banks are fighting this in state court and in federal court, because they don't like these super priority liens that give associations 6 months of back assessments, you know, that sort of thing. They don't like this. And they don't want to pay any assessments, you know. So they're fighting over that. And that's banks, you know, trying to insulate themselves against all this loss. Fannie Mae and I think, and the FHA have jacked up the requirements for, in Fannie Mae's case, buying mortgages, in FHA's case, for insuring mortgages. And they look a lot more closely now at association finances. Are they collecting assessments, percentage of delinquencies? Do you have at least 10% of your budget in reserve every year, et cetera, et cetera? They're scrutinizing the whole project's finances now.
Which is good.
In ways of, what's that?
Which is good.
Yeah, they absolutely have to.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm not, well, I'm not, yeah, absolutely. I'm not talking in terms of good and bad. I'm just describing,
no,
you know, what,
no,
what's
understand.
Happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not advocating it for anything. I'm just saying this is what they're doing. And then what I see happening with the state and local governments is they have a tool they can use, too, which is the creation of special assessment districts of one type or another that are that will guarantee that certain things get paid for. So even if the association fails. So, you know, you can create a special assessment district that has the same boundaries as a subdivision. And then that subdivision, let's say there are, it's an HOA-run subdivision, and it's got a detention pond, which they call a lake or something, but it's really a water control feature. And that thing, you know, those things create liabilities and problems.
Yeah.
And they can breed mosquitoes. They have to be dredged. There's all sorts of stuff. What if the association doesn't do it? Well, if you create this backup district, if the HOA doesn't want to pay for it, make people pay for it because they control their own assessments, they say, oh, we're not going to pay for it, fine. You just activate the special district, they add it to your property tax bill, they make you pay it. And that's the kind of thing that I think we're going to see more and more of. In fact, in Florida, there's been a lot, and this is happening in other states too, increasingly the developers are, the real action now for big developments is to create a multiple function special district that can do almost all the things that a municipality can do. And this is actually a government, but it's not a municipality. And so in these big places like the Villages and Ave Maria and a number of other places in Florida, and they have a similar law in California, you can create a special district that can do almost everything that a municipality can do, including issuing millions or tens of millions of dollars in municipal bonds. So you can finance the infrastructure using the bond market, using tax-exempt municipal bonds.
Are you talking about CDDs in Florida?
Community Development Districts.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and they have other types of districts as well. They have also these the type of district like Celebration is a different type of a district, a special, in Ave Maria, they're special legislatively created districts. Then they also had about 600 CDDs, huge default rate, like a 15% default rate on these bonds. But people still buy them bonds because they're going to get something, because there are still owners living there and paying, so they're going to get something on these bonds, so they're not completely valueless. But these are, developers can get very, very wealthy off these because they control
yeah.
the homeowner association, the whole subdivision, and they control the district
yes.
completely.
Yes.
And they can just make any deal they want with themselves. You know, they can sell the common areas
right.
from that they own to the district at any, and name their own price and pay themselves with money that is forever going to be paid off by the owner, by the residents through their property tax bills
right.
On that line item of the district on their property tax bill. So, and in a situation like this, these are going to get paid. You know, it doesn't matter what happens to the homeowner association. The HOAs can collapse. It doesn't even matter because the special district will assess them forever because they live in the district and they own property. So, you know, I think there's a lot of this insulation going on. And it's developers and cities and banks and financial institutions and so forth, government-sponsored entities are reducing the risk that HOAs pose to them. But you know who isn't getting protected?
The homeowners.
The homeowners. They don't even know what the risk. The homeowners don't even know what the risks are.
They don't. They don't. And that's why I still do the show, trying to get that information out there, because people need to know.
Well, they do, but for some reason they don't seem to find out. You know, the information is there. You're offering it. I try to inform people as much as I can, and a lot of other folks do, but, you know, the average, how do you reach people when you're talking about the average homeowner? You know, the average person going out to buy a house, they don't encounter this information on the path to buying that house, do
right.
they?
No, they don't. And they go out, as I said earlier, it's an emotional purchase. They're wearing rose-colored glasses. They've got all of these beautiful pictures dancing around in their heads, and all of these things are just minor annoyances on the road to getting that house that they've been dreaming of.
Yep.
And then it hits. And then it hits. You've got to somehow separate out the emotional, and I don't know how to do that. I think all of us are susceptible to the emotional. Oh, I love this house, or oh, I want to buy a house. Or,
right, but it's not. That's true, Sue. But isn't this also true of consumer products generally?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the average American, yeah. is for the most part, in a large part of our lives, we are unthinking consumers, making impulse purchases of all sorts of things because of advertising that influenced us in certain subtle, unconscious ways.
Yeah.
We don't often even get what we're doing. We don't think many of these decisions through rationally, and we're not rational creatures. You know, we're affected by advertising. They tell people you're supposed to look a certain way, wear a certain thing,
yeah.
buy a certain product, and if you don't have it, you're no good. And people go out and do it, and they've sold. Americans have been convinced that homeownership means certain things, and that it's going to be good for them. Now, this current generation of millennials, these like 18 to 29 and maybe upwards, you know, to 39, I think they may have a different attitude toward homeownership than an older people, because they don't seem to be racing into homeownership at the levels we
yeah.
saw in the past.
Yeah.
In part, that's because financing is harder to get. It's also because they've got this heavy student, a lot of them have enormous student loan debt, and they really can't afford to borrow $150,000 to buy a condo. They're already $50,000 in debt on their student loans, for example. But there's also a sense that we used to think that buying a house was a great investment. And, you know, that belief has been shaken, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that housing prices, no matter where you buy, are going to go up forever? Really?
Yeah.
Do people still believe that?
But we did at one point, didn't we?
Yes, everyone did. It was considered a, as they say, a no-brainer, you know, that of course you should buy. It was people used to use that term. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. There was something else that you said in your blog, and I thought that was very interesting, and that's in Spain, everyone has got to be on the board.
That's correct. It rotates. The membership of the board rotates, and you have to take your turn on the board.
But is everybody qualified to be a board member? I mean, some people just should not be on the board because they do make some really ridiculous decisions.
Yeah.
Or they're little Nazis, or whatever you want to call them. I know I'm offending some people, but I don't know how that works out so much, but it's interesting that you have to be on the board.
Yeah, that's the only country that does this, as far as I know, and as far as people at the conference knew. Yeah, it's right now, but look at it from another standpoint. Right now, with people choosing to be on the board, we still have lots of people doing it who don't know what they're doing.
Oh, I know. But sometimes when you know someone, it's a known quantity. You think, all right, I don't think that person needs to be on the board. I'll run against them. And so you can sort of take care of it. And I just read an email from someone who was sent an email by the association attorney telling them that they were not allowed to run for the board because they had sued or threatened to sue the association.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So here you've got the HOA attorney saying, oh, no, you may not run. You're not eligible to run for the board. You sued the association. So that's the exact person that I would want on the board, I think.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. The, it's always such a crapshoot. You never really know what's going to happen after an election. Will you get a good board? In some places, you know, because you have people who have served on the board for a long time, and many associations operate just fine. They have three or four or five people that are on the board, and they've done it for years, and they know what they're doing, and they're nice people. But, you know, as they say, you're always potentially one election away from disaster. You just never know.
Right.
And because so few people participate in association politics, that's what I think is underlined by the Las Vegas HOA takeover ring. That is what really just ripped the curtain away from all this nonsense about this local participatory democracy that's supposedly going on. I mean, these guys, this ring of people came in, and they just took associations over with straw buyers and, you know, rigged elections and bullying people. They just took these associations over. I mean, and that, of course, that's wrong. They're criminals. A lot of them are going to jail. That's great. But what does this say about homeowner association governance? What does this say? Because what it tells me is that it is very, very vulnerable.
Yeah.
It is this culture of non-participation that everyone in the industry knows. Everyone in the industry, the lawyers, the managers, everybody says the same thing. It's a culture of non-participation in almost all associations. And that leaves them wide open to the wrong people running them, including, potentially, in the worst situation, criminals.
But the thing is, people don't buy a house to run a corporation. They buy a house to raise their family. I mean,
yeah, I know.
You know, it's just, I don't know. We've just taken two entirely different things and we've thrown them together. I sometimes wonder if we should separate out the governance from the association. You look at places like Paris and London where you have buildings that would now be called condominiums, but were just buildings before, where people actually owned their units, but there's no legal structure there to support it. It's just the individuals get together, they hire a manager, they tell the manager what to do, they have an annual meeting, they get a report from the manager who says, I think we're going to need to paint this and that and the other, and I've got some bids, so they decide yes, and so we're going to raise the assessments to this amount. You pay the manager. The manager maintains that and takes care of it. The manager is actually an employee. In the States, the manager is fining you because you have a hose that you didn't get permission to have in your front. I mean, there's a whole different idea, the whole different way of looking at things.
I know, but if what you're suggesting, and if you are suggesting that 330,000 associations in the United States, that all these associations could turn into voluntary organizations without a total catastrophe resulting, I have to say I don't buy it. I don't believe that you could just disband all these associations and everyone would start seeing to it that the trash got picked up and the lawns got mowed and everything got fixed. I don't think that this would happen. That's basically kind of the anarchy approach. You know, do away with all the command and control, and then suddenly everybody spontaneously does everything that they're supposed to do. I just think that's definitely not going to happen, and that we don't have that strong communitarian spirit. In some associations, that would work. You know, like in my neighborhood, we don't have an HOA. And it's remarkable how high the property maintenance standards are, just because that's what people in the neighborhood do, and there's social pressure. I can show you other neighborhoods where that's not happening at all. Some people need some kind of structure. They're not even going to mow their lawns. Where you know they've got cars up on blocks, all the traditional stereotypes of why you need an association. You know, such neighborhoods actually do exist.
Oh, I know, so and I some of them are in HOAs as well. And some of them are in HOAs as well. But the thing is, you've got this mother thing. I mean, I need a mother. I need to be told whether I can put the trash out or whether I've got permission to put a mezuzah on the door. You know, there's this whole infantile way of looking at things that I think is what bothers me so much. It's like if you're an adult and you're old enough to get a mortgage and responsible enough to get a mortgage, then go for it. If there's a problem, have your the neighbors can get together and work it out. I know it's not always going to work. I understand that. I understand that. But
well, people who want that, I mean, obviously this is problem number one. The people who want to live that way without any association around need to not buy property in common interest housing development.
That's true. That's true.
You know, that's where we get back to the issue of things like these mandates. That we see around the country. They're not everywhere, but there are a lot of places where, obviously, the choice has been taken out of the market. And that's one of the other. If you say where do we go from here, one of them is, as I was saying earlier, I think much more disclosure of association finances. Yeah. In a public way where anyone can get access to it easily. And the second thing really is this. I mean, we need a kind of disclosure that actually works. We need disclosure that keeps associations honest, that keeps management companies from charging bogus fees and that you find out about only after the fact. You know, if you want the market forces to work, the information has to be much more freely and readily available at a much lower cost to people. It has to be like practically free information. And then maybe, you know, there'd be more choice. And the other thing that goes along with this is municipalities have to make sure there is choice in the housing market. And these mandates are part of the problem, because how do you know whether people want to live in a condo or not if you have all condos and no co-ops, for example? Or how do you know they want to live with an HOA if every single new subdivision has an HOA and you can't buy anything else? I mean, you can't, you know, that's why I say the industry and policymakers can't have it both ways. I mean, this is what they currently have. They have it both ways. That's wrong.
No, I mean, I agree.
Either people have choices and they have information, in which case it's legal to hold them to their bargain, or in the current situation, they don't have choices and they don't have the information, and then they're being held to the bargain anyway. That's what's wrong.
Evan, thank you so much for joining us. I've loved having you on. I hope you'll come back on really soon.
Well, congratulations on, what's it, 15 years?
15 years on this show, yes, on The Commons.
Well, you're doing great work, Sue.
Thank you, Evan. And thanks for joining us, everyone.
My pleasure to be there. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect. All my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs. Life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos. Someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.